Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous Reads. Today we have Dr. Claire Wright, her book, You Daughters of Freedom, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World. And just to let you know a little bit about Dr. Claire Wright, is an award-winning historian and author who has worked as an academic, political speechwriter, historical consultant, and radio and television broadcaster. Her most recent book, prior to this one, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, won the 2014 Stella Prize and the 2014 NIB Award for Literature and was shortlisted for many other awards. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Claire.
Thank you. It is absolutely gorgeous to be here, if I can say that.
You very much can say that and should all the time. We recommend it. I'm going to introduce this book because not only is this story that you engrossingly tell us in this book not known even in Australia, but it's become forgotten elsewhere as well. Because at one time, and because of these sort of five trailblazing women that you highlight in your book, Australia was the world's shining example of democracy. Tell us why.
It sounds like an absurd statement, doesn't it? But Australia at the turn of the 20th century was the world leader in democracy because it was the first country in the world to give women full political equality with men, meaning the right to vote and the right to stand for parliament. So New Zealand women had become the first in the world to win the right to vote in 1893, but they didn't get the right to stand for parliament until 1919. And as some of your listeners will know, because last year was the centenary, some British women got the partial vote in 1918, but not full political rights until 1928. American women didn't win the right to vote until 1920. French women not till 1945. Swiss women until 1975. So Australia was really out there on its own in terms of this progressive politics, in terms of the fact that it had found a solution to what at the time was known as the woman problem.
Throughout history, even in the 1400s, is it the women question? I don't know why we have to keep learning it. We have to keep recognizing it seems to be cyclical that half the population is, oh yeah, women. But we do.
Because what we all know is it's not a woman problem, it's a man problem. It's men who have a problem with women who want to occupy the same social, political, and economic space as men. And this is really what was happening at the turn of the 20th century. It was a global demand by women to have the right to vote, something that seems so absurd to us now that you know, we take it for granted. We take our vote for granted. But all around the world, there was this question of what to do with these demanding women who wanted the franchise.
And as you quote in the beginning of the book, by Frederick Douglass in 1857 said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So this was the moment when women were demanding. And one distinction that you make very clear, and we should make clear here, is that this was white women.
That's right. So it's what takes the gloss off this book being a kind of celebratory nationalist narrative for Australia. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to claim a world first. And certainly at the turn of the 20th century, in its own time, the whole world knew that Australia was way out in front. The whole world was watching Australia. Something that Australians just can't quite believe themselves these days because, you know, they only really pride themselves in international terms on the ability to beat other countries in sport.
The Ashes,
you know, they win swimming medals at the Olympics, these kinds of things. But to think that we were the leaders in progressive politics is extraordinary, and that the rest of the world knew this and that Australia was an acknowledged leader. What takes the gloss off that claim to preeminence was that the very same Act of Parliament that enfranchised women also disenfranchised all Indigenous Australians, the Australian Aboriginal population. So as many of your listeners would know, Australia was colonised by the British It was claimed in 1788 as terra nullius, no man's land, as if no one occupied it, except there had been people there for 60,000 years. The Australian Aborigines are now considered and acknowledged to be the world's oldest civilization. And the dispossession of the Indigenous people was complete. And by the turn of the 20th century, the logic was that they were a dying race, that the ones who were still there, who hadn't been completely massacred in the frontier wars over the course of the 19th century to claim that land, that those that were still there were considered to be either dying out or being assimilated into the white race. And so it was not considered to be in any sense a big deal to take those rights away from Indigenous people. But that's exactly what that Act of Parliament did. So, you know, in one way, writing this book is a kind of flag-waving exercise, but it's not a jingoistic exercise, because it's really important to recognise the historical context in which these wins for Australians, particularly Australian women, were won. There's a bracket. So when I say Australian women were the first in the world to win full political equality, you have to hear that as Australian white women.
Mm-hmm.
White in brackets there.
Exactly. So first, I'd love to hear about these five individual women, but also what we don't know. When we think of suffragettes in particular, we think of the Pankhurst family. You know, that's immediately what pops up. But what we don't know, and what we don't until now sort of remember and acknowledge, it was these women who came over from Australia who helped them to get us suffrage, which is fascinating. I don't think that was known. And also put themselves at great risk to do so. So if you could introduce us to Vida Goldstein, for example.
Okay, so, you know, this is what is so ironic about the story. It's not just people from the UK who don't understand that Australian women were so important to the British suffragette movement. Australians don't know this story either. We have lost this history. So more Australians would know the names of the Pankhursts than they would know Vida Goldstein. But Vida Goldstein was a complete and utter bloody legend, and everyone in the world knew who she was. She went to America in 1902. She's the first Australian that I can find who met a president in the Oval Office. She met Teddy Roosevelt because he wanted to see what, in his words, one of these enfranchised women looked like. So it was an experiment. This whole idea of giving women the right to vote was an experiment. And Australia was seen as being like the poison tester of the world. So what was going to happen once you gave women the right to vote? The whole argument against women having the vote, which had been rolled out since at least the 1850s, was that women were going to become unsexed, that they wouldn't want to get married anymore, that they wouldn't want to have children, that they would become manly, that it would be the end of the family. You know, basically this whole kind of, it'll be a disrupt social order and the sky will fall. So Vida Goldstein was the woman who in Australia was the leader of the suffrage movement. Now it's important to make the distinction that Australia didn't have suffragettes. Australia had suffragists. And suffragists are like people anywhere in the world who wanted and advocated the right to vote, both men and women, are called suffragists. Britain had suffragettes who were women and men who were members of particular suffrage organisations at a particular time in British history. And those were those militant suffragists. So Vida Goldstein was Australia's most prominent suffragist. She had come from a good middle-class family, Western District, not going to mean much to your readers, but your listeners. She came from a very moneyed, propertied family, very well educated, And early on in her life, she decided that she was going to eschew marriage, eschew children, and work for the betterment of all women and children. And she dedicated her life to that task. So her first step was to win those rights for Australian women at home. And then she took her message to the world, first Washington, and then later at the invitation of Emmeline Pankhurst, who knew of Vida Goldstein because all suffragists around the world knew of Vida Goldstein. She invited Vida to come to London to inspire, to lead, to help campaign for, and to learn new strategies for the British suffragettes, particularly the Women's Social and Political Union that Emmeline headed up. Because by 1911, so the WSPU was formed in 1903, by 1911 they were exhausted. Year after year, promises were being made and they were being constantly disappointed. November 1910 is Black Friday, that terrible day in British history when all those women were assaulted, beaten, some sexually assaulted, outside Westminster, protesting for their human rights. That had happened. Emmeline Pankhurst's sister had died as the result of injuries, and they needed something new, they needed something fresh, and they invited Vida Goldstein to come, and she did. She sailed over and she stayed in Britain for almost all of that year. And the title of my book, You Daughters of Freedom, actually comes from a letter that was written to Vida Goldstein by the other Emmeline, Emmeline Pethick Lawrence. And that it was a document that I found from in the Women's Library here in London, where she said on Vida's departure, and she gave her a beautiful necklace and some jewels, and she said, "Thank you for all that you have given us, and you daughters of freedom, you go back to the new world and you enjoy the rights that we are still struggling at home to proclaim."
That relationship of mother and daughter is something that is, I think that was really your spark. You saw a banner that Dora Meeson Coates had painted around this same time, sort of showing off and proclaiming to the world that Mother England, who had been our colonial mother, is not doing what this little daughter has done. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh my God, isn't this just the best story?
It's beautiful.
So, Dora Meeson Coates is another one of the women that I follow in this book, was an Australian artist who was living in Chelsea as part of the Australian expat artist community. And in 1908, she had become entrenched in the Women's Suffrage League, the Women's Freedom League, so also a militant group, but not the WSPU. And she was involved in one of those huge suffragette rallies that started happening around that time. And she painted a magnificent banner. It's about 2 meters high and 1.5 meters wide. And it was quite unusual for one of the suffragette banners because most of them were embroidered or sewn, and hers was painted. And it bore a story on it. Through the allegorical images it portrayed, that everybody at the time would have understood. Here was an image of Mother Britannia staring diffidently off into the distance, holding her trident. And there is Daughter Australia, Daughter Minerva, at her feet, reaching up to her, imploring. And at the top of the banner is painted the words, "Commonwealth of Australia," and underneath it, "Trust the women, mother, as I have done." Now, this is an extraordinary piece of allegorical effrontery. This is Australia telling Mother England how to suck eggs. It is a total inversion of the mother-daughter dyad.
The cheek of it.
The cheek of it. The colonial hide that was shown in that banner. And this was paraded down the streets of London. Everybody understood the message. It was paraded again in 1911 at the women's coronation procession on the 17th of June.
What was that? It was on the eve of the coronation of the king.
Of George V.
Yeah.
And the suffragettes were, and the suffragists, also the constitutional suffrage campaigners, were united in their anger and their humiliation that no women had been included in the festivities for the coronation of King George. So they decided to have their own rally that would both show their loyalty to the king as good British subjects, but also make their consistent demand that women be enfranchised. And all of the suffrage organisations came out in this parade. It started at the Embankment and it ended at Albert Hall. It took 5 hours for the procession to pass any one point along that route. Hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets of London to see them go past. And at the front of the parade were New Zealand and Australia, because they were considered to be the leaders of this movement. What everybody else was aspiring to have, that they already had achieved it. They were the heroes. And there were thousands of banners paraded that day. And the Australian women, the contingent of them, a huge contingent of Australian women who were living in London at the time, marched behind Dora Mason Coates's banner. What's incredible about this story is that that banner then disappeared. It turned up 75 years later, folded up in a little heap at the Fawcett Library, which is now the Women's Library at LSE. And they became aware that this was probably something that was valuable, and there was an Australian feminist historian, Dale Spender, who was living in London at the time, and she recognised what it was. And that started negotiations back with the Australian government. And this happened to be 1988, the bicentenary of Australia, celebrating that British conquest in 1788. And the Australian government bought the banner back as a gift to the women of Australia. Now, it should have been a gift to the people of Australia, but it was phrased at the time as a gift to the women of Australia. And it now hangs in Parliament House. And it's totally unknown, even though it should be our prized possession, even though we should consider it one of our founding documents, because it tells this story of Australia's preeminence. And one of the reasons that it's so important that Australians know this history is because 1901 was when Australia became a nation in the first place. So Australia was the newest nation in the world right when this was happening. And so this is a foundation story. This idea of Australia holding this particular position in the world of democratic preeminence should be a story we all take some pride in, that at least we know. And then we can layer it with the nuance of racism and xenophobia. But we should know it, but we don't.
How difficult was it for Australian suffragists to get the vote? Because as you're saying here, you know, there were a lot of deaths, you know, a lot of people had to be force-fed and throw themselves under you know, horses and, you know, what's that? We are familiar with that narrative of a long time, of it being partial, and of it being a bloody, bloody battle. Tell me about the battle in Australia.
It was completely different. And this is why the timing with Australia becoming a nation at this time is so important. Because it's a point in world history where global feminism dovetailed with this parochial federalism that was going on in Australia. So for about 20 years in Australia, there had been a movement towards a federation of the individual colonies. And bear in mind, at this stage, New Zealand is not a nation either. New Zealand is another colony. And it was mooted at the time that New Zealand might join the federation and become the 8th colony in the Commonwealth of Australia. And there was all sorts of negotiations that had to go along with that, because the colonies had powers, and just like Frederick Douglass's quote, nobody who has power will give it up easily. So there were a whole series of negotiations about what the new nation, what powers they would have, and what would remain with the states. And into that, feminists, suffragists came and said, we women will help you forge this new nation, but we want to be recognized as citizens of this nation. We will campaign, we will organize, we will demonstrate, we will negotiate, all the things that women are great at doing.
Unifiers.
We will unify, we will mobilize, we will fundraise, we will communicate, we will take to the streets, and we will talk to our neighbors, and we will be the political agents that women have always been, but we want our civil rights as our reward. And without going into the kind of constitutional mechanisms by which that happened, although that's a great story in itself, that's how they ended up winning those rights.
They had something to offer, whereas women in other places were perceived as taking something that was in the men's domain.
They weren't taking anything away. They were value adding to this mm-hmm. new nation. And even the anti-suffragists, who were posing all of those same arguments that they were all around the world about, you know, no women will ever want to marry again, la-di-la-di, they're just going to vote for the politician who's the most handsome, because, you know, clearly all of our politicians are such good lookers. All of those arguments, just all the politicians who were preferring those arguments, just did a complete U-turn once Australian women were actually voters. And this is why Australia was the poison tester of the world as well, because Australian women could then go out campaigning on the basis of the fact that all these prophecies of doom, they were not realised. And in fact, women's suffrage had brought nothing good, nothing but good, to this new nation. And this is what people like Vida Goldstein, one of the things that she did was she organised to get all of the male politicians who were part of that first Commonwealth government to write letters of endorsement saying how important, how beneficial, how advantageous to the new nation women's suffrage had been. And then these letters she then forwarded back to Britain. And this actually went to the point where in 1910, the Australian Senate passed a resolution that was forwarded to Prime Minister Asquith. So this 1910, the same year as Black Friday, forwarded a motion of Parliament suggesting that it would be in Britain's interest to do what Australia had done. Now, there was quite a lot of consternation in the Parliament about whether that was a good idea, like whether talking back to Mum was it going to be in Australia's best interests. But it was passed, that resolution was put to Asquith, and Australians really were very proud of their achievements at this stage. And one of the things that my research actually turned up was that Vida Goldstein organised that Senate resolution. She actually wrote it. So, you know, they weren't just kind of waiting in the wings, doing the kind of, you know, campaigning sort of from a distance. They were right there in the ring. And indeed, as I mentioned earlier, Australian women were also the first in the world to win the right to stand for Parliament. And Vida Goldstein did just that in 1903. She didn't win, but she showed that women could campaign and that they could be in the ring. She threw her hat in the ring and she was acknowledged as being an incredible candidate. And she actually stood for election 5 times. She never won, but the reason why it was given at the time was that she didn't join the Labor Party. She stood as an independent because she felt that if she joined a party machine, that what she really stood for, which was the interests of women and children, would get subsumed in the larger party politics and that her voice would get drowned out. Something that has actually, you know, with hindsight, been borne out. But she put her principles in front of her politics in a way, and that did cost her a seat in Parliament.
Cost her a seat in the Parliament, but not at a seat at the table. As you're saying, if she did author that proposition, that went through. But I suspect she's right that her message would have been diluted by that. Can we talk about some of the other women? Nellie Martel, Dora Montefiore, and Muriel Matters. Mm. Tell me about these women.
Okay, so the incredible thing about these women is that they were all household names in their own era. They were internationally recognised. Muriel Matters was known as, she was known around the world as that daring Australian girl. And her story is incredible. So Muriel was the youngest of the five women I follow. Born in the 1870s. So she missed really that time of suffrage agitation in Australia. The reason she came to London originally was to be an actress. So she had a reasonably successful career in Australia, but at the time what you did, and you know, some would say you still do this, if you want to prove yourself, you leave and you go to the metropolis. And this is exactly what Muriel did. And when she arrived in London, she had what we probably would call now kind of a Me Too moment. She went into the theatre and she discovered that all of the actresses there were being completely exploited, and many of them, in fact, being sexually exploited and drawn into what they called the white slave trade, which was prostitution. And it was an incredible euphemism, isn't it? The white slave trade. And so she decided to kind of organise, and she kind of tried to unionise the actresses. And she started to become kind of politically aware through that. But her story really changed when she went to one of Emmeline Pankhurst's meetings in 1905. And she sat in the audience and she had a revelation that her mission in life was to still be an actor on the stage, but to be a political actor on the political stage.
She got woke.
She got so woke, that girl. And she ended up using all of her skills and talents, which were many. She was very forthright. She was an elocutionist, as many of these women were trained to. So she could speak for hours on end. She could project to the back of the room. And most importantly, she had what at the time was considered to be a particular Australian kind of risk-taking, that she was very physically risky. And you know, all of those suffragettes put themselves at physical danger, just going out into the open, standing in a public square and having demonstrations, which interestingly I discovered that Nellie Martel, another one of those Australian women, was the first woman to suggest doing that. And she led Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst outside Parliament to have the first open-air meeting, which then became the symbol of the suffragette movement. Muriel Matters took that one step further. And in 1908, she pulled off this incredible stunt. So one of the things that suffragists and suffragettes were absolutely appalled by was the fact that in the British House of Commons, if women wanted to watch their political process going on, they had to sit in the ladies' gallery, which was up in the heavens. You had to have a ladies' ticket to get there, and most gallingly, you had to sit behind a metal grill. It made them feel like monkeys at the zoo. And the official reason for the grill that was given was that they didn't want the Parliament didn't want the MPs to be distracted by the vision of women in the House. But what all the women felt was a sense of segregation, that they were part of, and this is a little, throwing in a little bit of racism from the times, that they felt they were part of an Oriental harem, they would say, you know, a sort of apartheid. And so Muriel decided that she was going to use this symbol of oppression to her advantage. And she went up into the ladies' gallery one day, and she had a loop of chain around her waist. It was bolted around her waist with a Yale lock. And then on the other end, she had another Yale lock. She waited for 3 hours until she got her opportunity to rush to the front of the gallery, quickly loop the chain around the grill, lock it tight, and shout out, "Votes for women! Votes for women!" She unleashed, there's another woman with her, Helen Fox. They unfurled a banner that said "Votes for Women" through the grill, and they had one male politician who was also on their side. We might call him a male champion of change these days. And he started throwing up "Votes for Women" pamphlets in the chamber. And then Muriel Matters is credited as the first woman who ever spoke in British Parliament because she made a speech shouting it while police and the guardians of Parliament were trying to unleash her. But she was well and truly chained. And in the end, what they did was that they cut out the whole piece of the grill and they carried her down back down the stairs and out through Parliament, still locked to this like 2 meter grill. Do you think it made the front page of the papers? Of course it did. And there were illustrations of her being chained to it, of her and her shouting and gesticulating. And she had pulled off the biggest publicity coup of the suffragette movement to date. And she became an overnight sensation. She followed it up a few months later with her second incredible act, which was to harness the symbol of modernity. So the idea that women should be citizens of this new modern world, she harnessed the symbol of that, which was flight. People had only just started going up in the air. She hired a balloon, a dirigible, they called it at the time, a hot air balloon. The owner allowed her to write votes for women across it. She went up above London. Her plan was to follow along the procession of King George going to open Parliament for the first session of 1909. It was a pretty windy day and she went off course. It didn't quite work out that way, but she did manage to rain down upon London 50 pounds of leaflets, Votes for Women leaflets. And again, incredible headline-grabbing story that just raised the profile of the women's suffrage movement. She went to jail after the grill incident. Obviously, it didn't put her off. She was back up there in the air. And then in 1910, she went back to Australia and she did a speaking tour of Australia, telling Australians how ghastly the situation was for their British sisters. And she met Vida Goldstein and they hooked up together and she became a sensation in Australia, but she went back to Britain and she just kept at it, and she went all over the countryside giving talks. She eventually stood for Parliament in the seat of Hastings, which is where she died in the 1960s, lived a very long and full life. No Australians know her name today. Well, a few of us are trying to change that situation. The fact that she was such a sensation in her own day and is unknown today is just appalling. It's a tragedy.
But it's also a symbol of Australian gumption in an age where literally just making yourself visible was out of women's league. Yeah. Tell me about Dora Montefiore.
Okay, now sometimes I get asked which is my favourite of the five women who I follow, which is a bit like being asked who your favourite child is. You're supposed to say I love all of them equally. But, you know, I probably do love Dora Montefiore the best. I knew nothing about this woman when I started the research for my book. But Dora was extraordinary. She was English born. She was raised in the Victorian nursery, her term. So a very comfortable middle class background. One of her brothers went out to Australia in the 1870s and she was called to come out to help him a few years later. So she came out to Australia in the 1870s. She married an Australian, a British man, George Montefiore, who was part of the Montefiore clan that was, you know, some people will know Lord Montefiore here in Britain. They were a big Jewish family that had branches all over the world. They were they were mercantile. They had commercial interests. They had pastoral interests. They had mining interests. They had financial interests. And Dora met and fell in love with George Montefiore. She, so far, you know, reasonably ordinary story. It all turns around when George dies of a strangulated hernia on a trip, a sea voyage back from London, leaving Dora with two small children, a two-year-old and a four-year-old. Dora realizes that she's luckier than most women because she has financial support. She is not going to be impoverished by the death of her husband, which was so much the case for so many women. But she is absolutely incensed when she's told by her lawyer that she's one of the lucky ones because nobody in the Montefiore family is making a claim of custody for her children. She had no idea that in law, women did not have custody of their own children. She decided there and then that she was going to fight for the rights that other women who were less privileged and less fortunate than her were never going to be able to fight for themselves. And she started the first women's suffrage society in New South Wales. There was already one in Victoria, but she started the first branch in New South Wales. It went on to become a very important part of that Federation story that I was telling earlier. Dora then comes back to England, and she becomes an active part of the suffragette movement. She was one of the handful of women who started the first London branch of the WSPU. People who know their Pankhurst history will know it was started in Manchester. So the first London branch, Dora Montefiore is part of. And like many people, she later fell out with Emmeline Pankhurst, but in the days when she actively was working for them, she used her status as an Australian woman to her advantage. She called herself an Australian woman, and she made a stand in 1905 based on the essential components of democracy. No taxation without representation, yeah? And she says, in Australia, where I can vote and where I pay my taxes, I'm happy to pay those taxes because I get representation for it. But here in England, where I also pay taxes, I get nothing. And I'm not going to do it anymore. And so she doesn't pay her taxes that year. And what happens is what happens to people who don't pay their taxes. The bailiffs come in and they take property from your home and then they auction it off to the value of your tax bill. The following year, she says the same thing again. No representation, no taxation. But this time, she decides she's not going to let the bailiffs come in and take her property. She barricades herself inside her home in Hammersmith.
In West London.
She's just down on the Thames. She's got a big gate at the front, big front fence. She barricades herself in the house and she starts what is known in London as the Siege of Hammersmith, otherwise known as the Siege of Fort Montefiore, where she holds the bailiffs at bay for 6 weeks over the summer of 1906. And every day there's a band of suffragettes who come down and stand in front of her brick wall, and they sing suffrage songs, and they make suffrage speeches, and they throw loaves of bread and punnets of strawberries over the fence for her. And Dora comes up to her window on the second floor to her little balconette with her terrier dog under her arm, wearing her prim white shirts, and she makes speeches all day long. And she throws her white shirts over the fence, and the suffragettes take them off and get them laundered and throw them back the next day. And this goes on for 6 weeks. And of course, it's again, great news fodder.
And she did have special authority in that group because they had suffrage.
That's right. So the Australians had this moral high ground. The Australians had this this privilege, this status among the British suffragettes, and they listened to them, and they needed the guidance, and they wanted the strategy, and the Australian women used that to their advantage, and they saw themselves as part of a proud new young nation that was going to change the face of the world. And so they were like diplomats. They were like ambassadors. They were the unelected statesmen, except they were stateswomen, for a country. And so it wasn't just that they were using their statuses as women. They were using their status as enfranchised Australian women.
They were ambassadors of the brand.
That's right. They were Team Australia.
And so why is it so important to you and to us to tell this story now?
I think it's important on two levels. Home in Australia, it's important because this history has been lost. This history of Australia riding the crest of the wave of modernity, of showing leadership in what was considered to be the great moral question of the age, how to answer this problem of women's demand. And Australia found the solution.
They were on the vanguard.
Australia could be on the vanguard today. There is no reason why. We are a rich nation. We are a privileged nation. And we could be at the vanguard of nations, leading questions to do with the morality of our age. You know, to me, climate change seems to me to be a kind of parallel. It's a global issue. It's one the whole world has to come up with solutions to, just like they had to about women's suffrage 100 years ago. Australia has everything that it takes to play that leadership role again, but we have become so accustomed to see ourselves as followers. We follow other nations into wars that we didn't start, that we don't have an interest in. We follow timidly into various forms of policy making, of treaty making. We haven't come to terms with our own history. We haven't come to terms with our Indigenous history. We have treaties that need to be made in our own country. We need to be braver. We need to be bolder. We need to have a process of truth-telling that starts to recognise both the achievements of our nation, but also the missteps, also the atrocities of our nation.
A more balanced view.
A more mature view. Yeah. A more mature and a more honest view. A more independently minded view. And I think we need to be reminded that we once were that nation in order to be that nation again.
Give you the courage.
And, you know, lots of Australians have read this book and said, it makes me feel proud to be an Australian again. I didn't know this part of our story. And for the first time in so long, it makes me proud to be an Australian. Because, you know, many people on the progressive side of politics now are so disheartened by Australia's role in the world, but also what we are doing in our own shores, particularly in terms of the incarceration of refugees in offshore processing detention centres.
I say that has been the one thing that unfortunately the world has negatively looked positively towards.
You know, I know, that exactly. That's, you know, America is...
Yeah, like that's a great system.
Trump's
been
looking at us and going, boy, you Australians have got that right.
You know how to do it. Yeah, and you don't want a brand endorsement from that particular quarter.
It is so disheartening. And, you know, and so as a, in a sense, as a patriotic, but not jingoistic, as a patriotic and yet not idiotic Australian, I want to Australians to know and more have a more balanced, more nuanced and more evidence-based view of their history, because the message that we have been given, the narrative of our nation that has been taught in schools and sold through massive funding campaigns of our successive governments over the last 20 years particularly, is that the role that Australians played in World War I, particularly the landing on the beaches of Gallipoli, that particular campaign, and the Anzacs, we call this the Anzac myth, that this was the birth of the nation. And that this was the birth of the nation because this is when Australians proved themselves on the world stage. Generations of historians have used that logic. And it is completely factually incorrect, because my research absolutely shows from a substantial archival documentary evidence base that Australia had well and truly proven itself on the international stage, not through militarism, but through democracy. And I think that our history has become so militarized. And once you have a militarized narrative, you also have a masculinized narrative. And so the role that Australian women have played in nation building is completely swept aside.
That's been erased.
So there's a sense of restorative justice to it. I want people to know about these women because they're fantastic. And I want people to read the book because, well, as you know, you've read it, it's narrative history. I come from an academic background. The research is based in scholarship, but I write my books to be read like novels because the stories that they tell are so inherently interesting. These women were so engrossing that why flatten that story out with that kind of passive academic voice that so much history is written in? So I think that that is important on an Australian level. I said there were two reasons, and the second one in why I'm so excited to be in London now is because this is part of the British suffragette story. It's part of British history. And, you know, there was a slew of publishing that came out last year, the centenary of some British women getting the partial vote. But as far as I can tell, this story of Australians' role, their leading role, such a crucial role that they played in the British suffragette movement, that story hasn't been told. So this is part of British history too. And I would like to think that, you know, Britain wasn't particularly interested in hearing what Australia had to say about doing politics a century ago, but I'd like to think that times have moved on and that the British will take to an Australian telling them a slice of their history that they don't know.
Do you think it's also at a time when Julia Gillard is in power in Australia, that's a time to reintegrate this history and this part of your story?
Well, Julia Gillard, as you know, is no longer in power. Yeah. And one of the reasons why is because of misogyny, as she made very clear in that extraordinary speech that she made in the parliament, which has come to be known as the misogyny speech, and which had global impact because it spoke to all women around the world, because whether you were a prime minister or whether you were a factory worker, all women had been treated with a sort of contempt, and that Julia Gillard was treated with, the lack of respect that was shown to her as our first female prime minister, or any woman occupying any position of power. And I think that that's why she made such an impact. It was such a universal story. One of the things that I hope is that if we understand our history better, we understand the way that women who have claimed power, have attempted to claim power, and have been powerful in their right, have always been treated with that contempt, that we also can start to try to change that, to change that narrative, but also to realise that women make history. Julia Gillard made history. Vida Goldstein made history. I think it's in such an important message for young girls and boys to realise that women have always made history. That's what happens when your history is erased. You either become the victims of history, the passive victims of history, or you just believe that others are the change makers, that men have agency and women get left with whatever is left at the end of the day, usually the cleaning up. These women had agency. They were exerting it. And I think that the more we recognise that, the more young girls see that. And the reason I say boys as well is because maybe those boys who grow up to be men will have more respect for the women who are occupying space around them if they have a sense of admiration and respect for the women of the past who have also claimed space and who made things happen that we now think today is we totally take them for granted. What, women don't have a vote? Like, you know, why would you deny women the right to vote?
Well, the normalization of women having the right to vote should extend to the normalization of the idea that women created that.
It's also why I think language is really important, because often it's said Australia was the first country in the world to give women the right to vote and the right to stand for parliament. They weren't given shit. They won that. So you have to turn that around and say women won the right to vote. Julia Gillard won the right to be the leader of the Labor Party and therefore the Prime Minister of our country when Labor was in government. Rights are won. They're not given.
We've got to keep fighting. They, as we said in the beginning, they're not going to be given to us. They must be taken. Thank you so much, Claire, for taking the time to talk to Radio Gorgeous. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much for giving me so much space to tell what I think is a really fascinating story. I've loved it.
And for more fascinating women, please go to radiogorgeous.com.